Welcome to the Champions Rugby Show with me, James Burridge. We've got a treat for you today as we speak to a rugby coaching great who led Wasps to Heineken Champions Cup glory.
They are who they are because of their never-say-die attitude. But this is it. London Wasps have ended their season with the highest accolade that club rugby in this part of the world can offer.
My guest was a European Cup winner in 2007. He paved the way for Northampton Saints in the 90s. He played for and coached Scotland, winning the Grand Slam in 1990. We all know he's a British and Irish Lions legend. He's also the small matter of being a Knight of the Realm, no less, too. Let's speak to the one, the only, coaching royalty himself, Sir Ian McGeachan. Ian, thanks very much for coming on the Champions Rugby Show.
James, thank you. It's good to be speaking to you.
It's a crazy time at the moment. We know, fortunately, that rugby is coming back. Players are back into training now. Certainly in England, they hope to return mid-August, and Pro 14 towards the end of August. It's an exciting time. There's something to look forward to in rugby now, isn't there?
There is, and it's amazing. Obviously, it's the first time in my lifetime that there was a point with no rugby whatsoever to watch and no sport. I thank you. Appreciate really just how much sport brightens up your life when you've got something that you can watch.
What's lockdown been like for you? What have you been up to with no rugby to watch?
My garden's looking better, and it's the first time in my life that I've actually gone looking for weeds.
You and I think the rest of the country, the rest of our listenership. We've also seen that the Heineken Champions Cup have announced the fixtures for September, and there are some cracking quarterfinals coming up. We've got Clermont, Racing 92, Toulouse, Ulster, Exeter, Northampton, Leinster, Saracens. Which team from those do you think could go on to win it, Ian?
There's some good teams around at the moment. Racing, I must admit, I enjoy watching. I think they're playing well. But you can't get past that quarterfinal Leinster Saracens, can you? And they are two outstanding teams in Europe. And I think with sort of Racing in the background, I think it could be one of those three teams for me.
We're doing this podcast to celebrate 25 years of the tournament, which started back in 1995. Can you describe what the competition meant to you back then when it started?
The game was just going professional. And at Northampton at that time, we started part-time, I think, with the players before going full-time. There was a moratorium on with the RFU not allowing the English clubs to become professional. So it was quite an interesting time, but you very rarely played French clubs. And the fact that Europe started and the European competition, for me, and I think at the time I said it to the players, that they will get a completely different experience playing non-English clubs, and particularly the French, who were outstanding at that time. And at Northampton, I didn't want to win the league. Particularly, I wanted to win the European Cup because I felt that defined the rugby that you could play and what the challenge was. And at the club, we set ourselves a target to win it within 5 years and play the sort of rugby that was going to have to beat Toulouse in the final. At that time, Toulouse were the outstanding team. And I think the French teams dominated a lot of the European games in those early years. At Northampton, we set about trying to put a game together that would do that. And it was a great journey to be on with the players.
How different was it preparing for European competition, particularly the French?
Well, you didn't know, obviously, having the experience of international rugby and coaching, I just took that experience really and put it into the club scene of how we travelled, how we were prepared, how we trained. I lightened the load at the end of the week as I had done at international level and actually tried initially to replicate a lot of the things that I'd done with Scotland, particularly when you're travelling to France or Ireland. I remember, I think we had a breakthrough game, so we knew what we could do and how we could do it. We played Toulon very early in the years. I think it might have been 1996. It could have been, I think. And They hadn't been beaten at home for 4 years, and we beat them that day playing some exceptional rugby. Now, we weren't playing it every week and we weren't consistent at that stage, but actually I think that was an eye-opener for me and the players as to the type of rugby you needed to play, but actually what you could get from it. And that Toulon game, you pull up to the ground and remember you go up a very narrow road to the stadium and the supporters banging the sides of the bus and all the booing and noise that goes on around the ground. I think that was a really good experience at club level for us to show that the game was changing and actually what you needed to do had to be evolving as well. But that sits very high in my memory of a game where collectively it did help us redefine what we wanted to do.
And you brought in some decent players as well. I remember fondly Pat Lamb, who you brought in, and he was so influential in the back row for Northampton. What had you recognised in him about the role he was going to play in that Saints side?
Well, I'd met Pat a number of times before. Actually, I think we first met in the 1991 World Cup when Scotland played Samoa. And he always impressed me. He was about character and about players as people, and we just felt we were totally on the same wavelength, and I think it's something the club needed. We'd got good players, and just having Pat there just broadened, I think, the thinking of what we needed to do as a group. And then there was people like Freddie Mendes, Gary Pagel, who were outstanding players, and who I think I also enjoyed the family relationship and feeling and environment that Northampton had. And I, you know, you have to say Keith Barwell, the owner, Keith was a fantastic chairman and owner. And he allowed us to do things. And it was literally a journey where you were experimenting with things, but you had people that you could trust and talk to. Pat and I still talk rugby to this day on ideas and things. So he came and he just lifted the whole environment to another level. And with Tim Rodber, Budge Poutney, I mean, they did a tremendous back row. And we tried to experiment. We challenged each other to think differently and to do things differently. It influenced actually some of my approach to the 97 Lions in South Africa on how we had to win. And it was great to have that environment where you could have, you know, with Matt Dawson, Paul Grayson, Gregor Townsend, all these players where you just trusted them and you gave them the chance to do things. And it educated me. But we just had this environment where we were prepared to try anything and work something out and change something if it wasn't working. And as a coach, it was a fantastic environment to be in.
Let's hear from the aforementioned Mr. Lamb, who's obviously doing brilliant things now with Bristol Bears. Here's what he's had to say about you, Ian. It is a glowing tribute. I'm expecting you to blush. Let's see what he's had to say.
Keach has been a massive mentor to me. When he took me under his wing, and I still, even my last year of playing, he brought me into the Scotland setup. So I had a coaching contract and a playing contract, and then he... But his man management, but his way of thinking about the game really challenged me. You know, around continuity, around angles and lines and getting them behind the defence line and pouring through, you know, letting the ball carrier determine where he wants to go and the support read him. So I learned so much off him of that. And certainly when I was coaching, we played Yorkshire Leeds in the championship, my first year at Bristol, and Geach was there involved with Leeds. And I asked him to come and talk to the team. And, you know, we won convincingly, but he could see a lot of this. He enjoyed the way we play. And I said, mate, you realize that's a lot of stuff I got from you. And I asked him to come, and he was a little bit shy initially, but it was massive for our team when Geach came in and spoke to all the players. You know, a lot of respect from.
How about that, Ian? That's not bad, is it?
An incredible person, Pat. And, you know, as I said earlier, I mean, he's also the type of person, the player, that as a coach, you learn so much from. You know, that relationship, I think, when you get good teams, good people, good players together who are prepared to do that and have a very open mind. It just creates a fantastic environment to work in, and you just enjoy coming to the club every morning because you know you're going to be getting so much from it. It does. I'm delighted Pat is doing well. As I say, we still pick up at times on the phone and just chat, and you know, I'm just delighted to see how well he's doing. He's a tremendous coach for people as well, and he's got a fantastic environment now at Bristol. They are going to be one of the teams to watch, I think.
The most successful coaches are people coaches. You certainly get that sense. And I remember hearing Matt Dawson, who I know you're also extremely close with. And Dawson was saying the one piece of advice, I'm sure many pieces of advice you've given Matt down the years, but he was saying that when he first arrived at Northampton and he was trying to impress you, obviously, as this, you know, tenacious scrum half, and you just made it very clear to him that he said, listen, as a number nine, you just pass the ball or you make a break. And whichever you choose to do, do it 100%. And as long as you weren't hesitant, you know, you were going to back him. And he never had that clarity before from a coach. And it's so much that it struck me a wonderful example of how the relationship and the clarity of a coach is so fundamental.
Well, I think you like to think you can give players the confidence to play. I always felt that if a player saw a break or a half gap, don't half do it or tentatively try and it's not on, even if it's the wrong decision. If you then go for it 100%, the likelihood is you still control the situation. And if it does open up, then you're creating something which, you know, is devastating attack-wise. And, you know, Dawes, he was a brilliant scrum half. I mean, I think when he went on the Lions in 97, a few people questioned, but I knew under pressure, I knew how well he played and the sorts of decisions he made. He was a natural leader, and that grew up with Paul Grayson as well at Northampton, Tim Rodber at number eight. So you had a trio there of 8, 9, 10, which you know, had a really good thinking approach about things. And, you know, with Pat there and Gregor outside, you'd got a real... You know, again, as a coach, I felt privileged, actually, because I was part of a think tank and a playing approach that everybody was not just buying into, but was actually evolving and developing. And it helped me change and develop my own coaching thoughts. And you challenge every year to be better than you were the year before. And that's what we did. And I remember... Yeah, Dawes early on, as younger, used to try and make a break almost every ball. And I just asked him to said no. I said, remember, pass first, wait for the break, so that when it does come, you're leading to tries, and it is devastating. And but again, another person who I have a huge amount of time for, and just enjoyed his company on all that group of players, really, which was quite special on and off the field. So. Interestingly, that this five-year plan to win Europe was all part of the way we were devising. We kept devising the game. We kept watching Toulouse and see how they were going. And I say, it's not changing. They're still the best team. You know, look at the rugby we're going to have to play to beat this team in the final. And that's the challenge I set the players. And interestingly, it was a five-year plan, and thankfully they actually won it in 4 years.
Well, there's one of the great moments as this huge trophy is handed over to Pat Lamb. Pat Lamb, captain of Northampton. European Cup winners of 2000. Winners over Munster in the final by 9 points to 8.
Was that a bittersweet moment, Ian? I mean, obviously, by then you'd left the club and John Steele had taken over. But many... fans, if you speak to them now, and players feel that was your team that had created that moment. Yes, John obviously had a huge impact as well, but many felt that was your team too.
No, I'm just pleased I left them in good shape. It took us 3 years to really get to the rugby that collectively we had a consistency with. And the breakthrough year was 98-99. And... we finished that season, I think we put 50 points on Bath and we put 50 points on Newcastle. So we were playing fantastic rugby at that time and started, still at the beginning of that, following season, beat Leicester by 40 points. So that season, I felt, you know, Northampton going into the 99-2000 season, you know, felt that I thought the rugby then we were playing and the team were getting to a point where they could beat anybody. And yeah, unfortunately, I didn't really want to leave, but my wife was ill and we had to try and move on. And she had a guilt complex for 7 years until I won it at Wasps. And then she felt that she could relax again when we'd actually won the cup and you could actually touch it at Wasps a bit later.
Absolutely. Let's come on to the Wasps years then, because when you did join them, you joined a club who had just won their first Heineken Champions Cup in 2004. So, I mean, did you feel the pressure to emulate that success?
I felt it was the biggest challenge in some respects outside international rugby or the Lions that I had. You know, at club level, I'd coached my own club, Headingley, for 3 years and then got involved with international rugby. And then I'd come to Northampton and, you know, started in the amateur days with Northampton and come through the professional and you know, you get a real rapport with that. And we, as I said, with Keith Barwell and the crowd and everything, you know, Northampton is an incredible club to be able to be part of just because of its, you look at the ground now. So coming to Wasps in a way was completely different. They were successful. They'd got Lawrence Dallaglio as captain, and Warren Gatland was coaching before me. So they'd had a lot of success and a steady group of players. So as a coach coming into that, you know, I felt that was a big challenge, a different challenge that I'd not had before, coming into a successful environment, one that you hadn't sort of built up, as it were. Again, met up with Sean Edwards, picked up a rapport pretty early, which again was great, which is so important. And a new forwards coach, Leon Holden, who'd come in. And really, I just listened. My first couple of months, I did a lot of listening to the players, what they did. I'd got certain principles that I'd always had as a coach, but until I understood the players, I didn't feel that I wanted to necessarily change anything, just wanted to let them know the sort of things I was looking for, but actually me understand what the Wasps environment was, and spoke to Lawrence, Simon Shaw, Joe Worsley, Alex King, you know, some really experienced and natural leaders. And I still believe the first player that I brought in was Rafael Ibanez from Saracens. And Raf, again, became a very good friend and somebody amongst that group that you could bounce ideas off. And so gradually we sort of built and continued. I wanted to keep Wasps evolving so that our game, you know, wasn't something that was predictable. And again, you were in a good group of players who were prepared to challenge and look at things and be prepared to do things slightly differently if it was needed. And again, you know, 4 very happy years there.
You had a team of big personalities though, didn't you? You had Cipriani, Ibanez, as you mentioned, Dallaglio. How did you keep them all in check?
Well, I mean, it's easy. If somebody gets out of line, then generally the players sort them. There's one or two fights on the field sometimes. If Lawrence was just getting a bit too big, then Simon Shaw would sort him out. Or if somebody else was getting too big, then Lawrence would sort them out. So it's like anything. You're back to players want to win. They want an environment where they have an opportunity to succeed as an individual, as a person, as well as a player. And if you do that collectively, they have a trust and an honesty about what they're doing, then they, you know, they can rely on them. And you've got this environment where nothing's off limits. If something's not right, I always said it needs to be said early so you can sort it out. And, you know, that's what we evolved. So the team actually changed quite a lot over the next 3 years in personnel in some respects. But there was that very strong core there. You know, Lawrence virtually didn't play my first year there. He got that bad ankle break on the Lions tour in 2005. And so, you know, there was a good sort of collective direction from everybody, which impressed me. Joe Worsley impressed me. He's coaching in France now. But Joe, again, just a good thinker of the game. Alex King was outstanding. And then there were players coming through, Owen Redden, who became a Irish scrum half. Again, just a very clever player and a player who challenged you. As a younger player, he knew what he wanted. And, of course, Danny Cipriani, who'd come through the academy. That was the year. Danny, when he came in, he's got his first game for Wasps, was against London Irish. It was a bit like the Danny Cipriani show. He was doing long passes overhead. And at half-time, I said to Danny, I said, you're not playing to make the team work. And I brought him off. And then for the next five games maybe, Trey made him watch. And then I said, now, when Alex King, I think, had been injured, was fit again, I said, I'm going to play you at fullback, Danny. I said, because then from fullback, you can see just what's needed at 10 and how you bring players in and how you manage the game. And Danny played at fullback, and then in that European Cup winning year, ended up playing the whole season at fullback and played outstandingly well. And of course, was fullback in the final.
It's fascinating hearing you talk about those players and how almost each relationship with each one has to be different. It has to be nuanced. And the case of Danny Cipriani is another prime example. Danny is a player who has shone on the rugby stage, but he's been handled well by some coaches and it's gone wrong with others. In your experience, Ian, what's the best way to handle a player like Danny Cipriani?
Well, I think it's like this. I think he's got to understand what his priorities are and the impact he can have on a team. But also you want feedback from him of how he sees things, because you've got players who are very talented, who see things early. I think very good players in their head see things early and react quicker than other players. And it's been able to get that feedback of information and how they see it and what can be done. In a way, I had it a little bit with Gregor Townsend, that Gregor just saw things so quickly that he was way ahead of some of the players around him sometimes. And it was just making him realise, look, sometimes you're just going to have to be hold on to something or just delay something until you get the right support or the right angle from somebody else to be able to do something with it and just delay the pass. And Danny was the same. And he then came through. I thought he played the following year. He played exceptionally well at 10, but then broke his ankle, unfortunately. But he also got picked for England. And I'm not whether it was his first cap against Ireland at Twickenham. It was one of the most complete 10 performances at international level that I've ever seen. I thought he was absolutely superb that day. In his head, he knew what he was doing. He was doing it at the right time. And he had a game where the quickness of his thinking was just making things work. And, that's from a distance that, as a coach, the satisfaction you get when you see that coming out of a player.
Let's talk about that final then, the big season of 06-07. And you made short work of Leinster and Northampton in the quarters and the semis. I'm sure it didn't feel like short work because those are two pretty big European beasts in their own right. But Leicester were going for the treble that year. And you were definitely being painted as the underdogs. And I think you'd probably had 2 or 3 weeks off before, hadn't you?
Yes, we had. We didn't make the playoffs. We just missed out. I still think Leicester were very cute about what they did. I think they sent a second team to Bristol so that Bristol could beat them and get fourth place in the playoffs, which put us into fifth, keep us out of the playoffs. But yes, we had 3 weeks where we didn't play. So we put a training program together over that 3 weeks of what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do things. And I think the week before, could have been earlier, we then set up a game between the first team and the second team at Wasps, and we played at Henley. And it was full on. If I remember rightly, Leanne Holden and myself coached the second team because I wanted to put some things out to challenge the first team. And it was a very interesting game in which the second team, the players were excellent. And I think about after about 65 minutes, the second team were winning. So I got the message on the field to the ref to blow the final whistle, blow the whistle early within the 5 minutes. So it was great because it kept everybody on their toes. And then we went out for a meal together in Henley, had a really good evening. And then the week before that, we'd had, at the end of a training week, we had a weekend off, but we had a barbecue on the Friday afternoon together on the training field at Ealing. And so we tried to manage that 3 weeks very carefully on the field. And we'd played Leicester almost in the last game of the season in the league. And we lost quite heavily at Welford Road, although there were reasons behind it. We'd played with 14 men for a while. But we'd got two or three tactical things we'd picked out to do against them. But when it was obvious we weren't going to win, we got the message on the field not to use the tactics because we wanted to hold them back for the final. And we scored two tries from those tactics that we devised to play against them in the league, but then didn't use. And this was how they defended lineouts in their own 22. So we'd looked at it, and Leon Holden had said, well, look, we can do this in the lineout, which is going to create some space at the front. And we'd three separate moves to put runners in the space at the front of the lineout, where they'd got a prop, Julian White, defending, and that was it. And so that was what we put on ice, and then we brought it in and used it. And had it, you know, as a core part of what we were going to do, particularly in the first half against them, to really put them under pressure.
It's Redding from Inverness. Redding is going for the corner. Absolutely inspired. A thrilling score.
Well, what a combination. All the experience of Rafael Inverness, who was ecstatic when the score was completed, and Owen Redding, who has for me been Wasps' best player behind the scrum all season, has now scored in the Heineken Cup final.
Could you quite believe it? Because it was the same trick twice. It really was brain over brawn, wasn't it? And I remember watching that final and I couldn't quite believe that Leicester had fallen for the same trick twice.
Well, it was slightly different because the first time it set Owen Redden up round the front, and the second one was a slightly different move, which brought Simon Shaw round and had Raf Ibanez waiting on the touchline. So the setups were different, but the space where we knew we could create pressure was still there. It was two different ways of using the same space. And yes, they thankfully didn't pick up that, you know, that was an area we could and were obviously looking to attack.
Incredible. And at the key moments, London Wasps have found the ability to flick the switch. And it's Ibanez who's been pressing it.
What was that moment like, Ian? I think there were just over 80,000 in Twickenham for that moment. And for you personally as a coach, having got so close with Northampton, but not being there when they lifted it, to know that you were the coach who lifted it, must have been a hugely emotive day for you and everything you've worked for.
Yeah, it was. It was so different having, you know, not been with Northampton when they won it. As I say, it probably hurt my wife more than me, because I did get phone calls from Matt Dawson and Pat Lamb straight after the game. I think at club level, when you're dealing with players every day and you take them to Twickenham, and then you have a club day with supporters that you are seeing week in and week out, and then you get to something like that and you win it. And this was what I'd always felt, Europe. This defines the club. It defines you as a group, that you are for 1 year, you know, the best club in Europe. So it meant the final whistle. Yeah, it meant a huge amount. It was just good to see some of the younger players as well. Don Waldock, I remember being part of that group coming through. You know, there was a good group of young players who were all part of that. And it's just a really nice a really nice, satisfying feeling. And I think, you know, to be honest, as a coach, you get more satisfaction, I think, than I did in some of the wins I had as a player.
We mustn't let you go, Ian, without mentioning the Lions. Of course, this week they've announced the fixtures for a year's time, which really does, you know, whet the appetite for next year. And of course, you've been on two tours there as a coach of South Africa, winning and losing, and they have been very special tours in their own unique ways. What do you think the biggest challenge will be for Gatland's Lions in South Africa next year?
I think you can't get away from the fact that there's only five games before the test matches and not a lot of preparation time before that. Gats is clever. I mean, you know, he's been brilliant for the Lions, and as a New Zealander talking to him, you go back to 2009 and he gets the Lions, and it was pretty, you know, there was at one time early in that tour when I asked if he wanted to speak to the players before one of the games, one of the first couple of games, and he just turned to me, he said, no, at the moment, he said, I haven't earned the right to speak to these players as Lions, which I thought, you know, was he understood, and having played against the Lions, he understands, you know, just what it is that makes a Lions environment, I think, and because he understands it's going to take all his understanding and experience from the previous three tours he's been on to get the players involved in those first five games, because I still think that is very important, and that's going to be a big challenge for him, because particularly the Saturday games are, you know, big games. There are Stormers, the Sharks, and then the Bulls. And then into the test. So, you know, it's still managing that for players to feel part of that, particularly as there's then no midweek games between the test matches. But if you get that right, and I think one of the advantages is they are at sea level in that whole beginning of the tour, and then they up to altitude for the test matches, and they'll probably stay at altitude, just come down, play the second test in Cape Town and then move back up again. So from an altitude point of view, actually, it works well for the Lions. But I think that's the challenge, is being able to get that understanding and know without doubt, you know, as a player and coach, you can't get away from the physicality of the game in South Africa, that they're big men, they're powerful men, but actually they're clever rugby players as well. And people sometimes underestimate that. And we saw that in the final against England in the World Cup. And, you know, they're settled. Erasmus is a very good thinker and has managed them really well. So, you know, for the third time running, the Lions are going to be playing the world champions in South Africa. So it's fascinating. It's a challenge. I think Gats would probably not necessarily need extra games, but would prefer a couple of weeks at the beginning of the tour for preparation, because that does help without a doubt. And that managing that, I think, is going to be one of his biggest challenges.
And of course, Warren Gatland really developed, he earned his spurs, didn't he, as a coach in the Northern Hemisphere in European rugby, winning a title, of course, winning the trophy just before you. How do you think, as we kind of round things up here now, Ian, coaching in Europe has changed since you started as a coach at Northampton?
it's quite hard. I think it was going from amateur to professional. You know, obviously the first decade or more, 15 years of my coaching career was the amateur game. So you're talking about organising teams on a Tuesday and a Thursday evening, and you're putting everything in, or working at the weekends if it's an international team, and working for sometimes two and a half hours to just get things in. I think now just the professionalism of the analysis, the support services that are there, medical, all so important. But I think as a coach, and again, it was a big lesson I learned, is you have to be clever about what you present and have a clarity. And sometimes I think a simplicity. It's easy to overcomplicate. And I think as the game's got more professional, having that clarity about what you're doing and putting it into a session that's only an hour or an hour and 15 minutes long is actually the challenge, because it still might take you 10 hours of analysis, looking at things, to actually get that hour's session, so that everything that you're doing is actually going to have the right impact on the players, but also on the team and on the game and its outcomes. And I think that preparation, which is something I always tried to do, you know, even before the game was professional, is watching videos and looking at players. But even more so now, you've got all that information. It's actually having the clarity and the understanding, and, you know, I think using the players and their thinking, because certainly, you know, latterly, when you look at the players, I call it a collective intelligence, that there is so much understanding now within a group of players that you've got the majority of the answers as a coach. You don't have to be afraid of using that, but what you have to do is manage it so that you have that clarity and simplicity that comes out of it, that gives you a very clear tactical direction, and that working with support staff, medical staff, strength and conditioning analysis, and coordinating all that is now very important to you know, the coaches in the professional era as we have it.
Just to find a few questions, Ian, if you were still coaching now, which player in Europe would you like to work with?
I'd like to get my hands on Finn Russell, I think.
I think a lot of coaches want to get their hands on Finn Russell, don't they?
No, I mean, for the right reasons. And I think Gregor, you know, having coached Gregor, so I know as well Gregor Townsend, you know, I think with the experience of the last few months of not being involved and what he can do, you know, now he's in Paris, I think there could be, you know, some really exciting rugby comes out of him. And he could be one of the players that could well come on, and I'd be very interested to see him in an Lions jersey as well. And you know, one way of really taking South Africa on sometimes is you don't want to be over physical. You need to be clever and move them around and change your positions of attack. And when you've got players like that, then suddenly you can change the perception of the game that you play.
And finally, Ian, what would you say is your Heineken Champions Cup legacy?
I would just hope that I was part of something which gave players the opportunity to experience and enjoy the challenge of the European Cup, because for me, as you know, at club level, it is still the pinnacle. And to have that experience and to have been part of that experience is a very special experience to have.
Ian, it's been fabulous having you on the podcast. I could listen to you for hours. I could sit back, have a beer, and listen to you talking about rugby within a European context, the Lions. There's just so much fascinating stuff to hear from. Really enjoyed your time today. Thanks very much indeed, and enjoy the summer.
James, thank you.
Well, that was an absolute privilege hearing from Ian about everything European rugby and man management. The art of man management in modern day coaching was absolutely fascinating. Please subscribe to our Champions Rugby Show podcast via your favourite podcast provider. Leave us a review. We've got another European legend coming up shortly to tell you about. Make sure you tune in for that. But until then, from all of us, it's goodbye.